People looking for solutions to a tense climate between communities like Milwaukee and their police force could do worse than looking to the city of Cincinnati's example. The Cincinnati area's population is comparable to that of Milwaukee and, especially in the past, dealt with many of the same issues of mistrust between law enforcement and minority communities as this city has. But years of work in Cincinnati has led to a changed climate that's not perfect, but is a lot closer to ideal than it once was. The model for change is one that a group here called the Community Coalition for Quality Policing would like to see implemented in Milwaukee someday. Three key figures from Cincinnati spent time here recently to talk about that city's effort, and they joined us in the studio. Al Gerhardstein is a civil rights attorney and principal author of the Cincinnati Collaborative Agreement. Kathy Harrell is a Cincinnati police officer and past president of the city's chapter of the Fraternal Order of Police. And Iris Rowley is project manager for Black United Front and lead complainant in a lawsuit against the city of Cincinnati. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks.
Thank you for having us.
Where was the situation in Cincinnati between the police and the community when this work started?
The issues that you see today were the same issues that were occurring in Cincinnati. In the core of the city, in a core, in Black communities and police, same situations, police killings. My organization actually formed before the 15th unarmed Black man was killed by Cincinnati Police Department, Cincinnati Black United Front. We actually formed because the restaurants closed during one of our large events that targeted African Americans. And then we had what we call 2 and 24, Roger Owens being Jeffrey Irons. And the community was already feeling some pain and traumatized and really wanted something done this particular time. So they asked us to take a look, get engaged, get involved, and really put a clear focus on policing in the Black community. And that's what we did. And so my attorney, one of our attorneys are here, Al Gerhardstein, and the other partner, Cincinnati Police Department. So we sued the city and the police department for racial profiling and police misconduct in 2001. And now we have this agreement, which is called the Collaborative Agreement, attached to our DOJ reforms. And we, you know, feel like the grandparents around reforms and decrees and works and structural changes. We use a methodology called problem solving, which you'll hear more about. That the police use and the community uses. And we've been through a lot from tasers to now body cams. And so we are here to share our story and hopefully help Milwaukee.
Well, and before we get to that point, I'm curious to get the standpoint of where the police saw things at the time this work started.
Well, I'm in a very interesting position because when all of this was occurring, I was actually a police officer in the District 3 area as a neighborhood officer, working with the community. Prior to that, I'd been in the drug units. I'd been in different districts. I was involved in the union. I was sitting on the board as an officer on the board. And I saw it in a totally different light at that time. When they came to us about the federal collaborative, our attorney, and thankfully Don Hardin was very instrumental in trying to make sure that we did get together in this federal collaborative, that the police union actually sat at the table. I was a no vote. I knew that I didn't police with the way that they were stating that all police officers, I felt like we were all being put into one big basket. And I knew I didn't police that way. I was a no vote. Little did I know at the time that I'd become the union president. Ended up being the one sitting at the table and working on the issues. And I think for what one of the most important things that I saw come out of it was the fact that the administration kept saying that there was no change needed. However, even just being an officer on the street, I knew that change needed to take place. And the officers weren't being listened to. Because according to policy and procedure, you know, we can't speak out publicly. We can't say anything negative against the police department because then there's discipline. You do what your supervisors tell you. You police how you're trained. And that's what they were doing. And I think what really surprised a lot of people in this process is how much change officers did want, but that there was, up to that point, there wasn't a way to get it done.
Well, and so given that this change has already taken place, can you explain what it was that officers at the time thought needed to happen and how it shaped the solutions?
The police administration listening to the officers, they had some great ideas. We had, you know, everybody talks about community policing, community engagement. We had officers that were doing that every single day, but it wasn't called that. It was called being a good beat cop. I mean, there were officers that knew every single person in their community. They'd worked in that beat for 20 years. They knew who was running the families, who was taking care of the families, which problems, which kids, what they needed, who they could go to get some of those issues taken care of, but they weren't getting credit for that any kind of paperwork as far as the performance evaluations.
It's difficult to quantify that kind of work.
Exactly. It wasn't on our performance evaluation sheets. You weren't getting credit for it. What was on the performance evaluation sheets were amount of arrests, misdemeanor arrests, felony arrests, traffic citations, those type of things. Not, you know, the fact that you spoke with 20 citizens, that you, you know, gave them other type of assistance, that you're working on a community-oriented problem. So there were a lot of those type of things that they felt needed to be changed and they weren't being listened to.
And that's really... you're asking the wrong question when you just say, you know, what needed to be changed, because it was the process that actually shook up Cincinnati.
Yeah.
What we did is we invited the FOP and the city administration and eight different stakeholder groups to sit down and decide together what their vision of policing would be. And we had an online questionnaire. We had lots of small conversations throughout the community. We captured all of those conversations using qualitative research and fed back those ideas and then came to five consensus goals. And it was only through a very deliberate process of sharing our vision, explaining why it was important, then sharing all the ideas that our agreement then reflected the interests of all the stakeholders in the community. So the police officers and their spouses and the police administration and the Black community and the other business people and the do-gooders, all of those folks said, yeah, I recognize my vision for policing in your five goals. And that's what started us down a path of shared policing vision.
And the thing that's very important about the fact that like Don Hardin and Al had worked on is making sure, and our attorney made it very clear, the importance of us sitting at the table and having a voice instead of just sitting back and the administration saying what they thought needed to be heard and not really hearing what the issues were that the police officers saw. So us sitting at the table was very huge, that we actually had a voice.
Was it a painful process?
Oh, yeah. That's an understatement.
Let's just say that at one point during the, shortly after we introduced the idea of the collaborative, while the FOP was preparing to vote, while City Council was preparing to vote, we had our riot. Because there was another police shooting. And the community is not going to wait and say, oh, I see that you all have something in mind. So we were always playing catch up to the tension on the street. And that was frustrating. And then once we did agree on the collaborative, we had to sue to hold the city in contempt because they weren't implementing it with the same level of commitment that they were supposed to do, and they weren't doing everything they needed to do. So we had a struggle.
And let me just add this into it as well. I know that we often talk about the agreement, and it's one thing that I want people to understand is that we crafted an agreement that placed no blame. And it was very difficult to work through that, but we did it. And we were able to look forward. And sometimes in a very critical situation, when you're down on the ground and you feel like as if you can't go anywhere but up, you have to move forward. And we've come this far along with what we had to deal with.
It placed no blame. At the same time, during the process, were there admissions that on all sides that perhaps... things hadn't gone the way that were intended?
I don't think in the beginning, not at all. I think that's, you know, I mean, I have no problem sitting here saying it now, even though I'm no longer the union president, that, I mean, sitting at the table is the union president with the police administration sitting on the other side of the table and giving statements at the all parties meeting that I know are totally inaccurate, that that's not what's happening, that that's not what you're doing. You know, you're making statements here to try to get people, you know, to believe that you're really working towards this, but you're not doing it. And being able to sit there and say, hold on a minute, that's not true. That's not what's happening. You're not out on the streets. You don't know what is actually going on, what supervisors are telling these officers. And you really don't understand what is going on. And so it took a long time to get to that point. I mean, even at the very end when, you know, for us, we gave our members a 5-year commitment. We'll take your dues, pay an attorney for 5 years to make sure that our interests are covered and we're at that table. And then when it came about, you know, Al, you know, was there, but and Iris in front of the Federal Monitor and everyone else and saying, you know what, the city hasn't done what they need to do, so we want a year extension. However, the FOP has shown their commitment. We released them.
Right.
That was huge for us. Absolutely huge for us.
I think the uptick was that we all came to the table agreeing that we would have a shared policing vision. a shared safety vision. And that's much different than being stuck in blame. That truly is getting to the work.
It's also different, though, than what some people, I mean, we just didn't have it. We didn't implement it the same way. For example, our police chief continued to have a vortex unit, which is a stop and frisk, zero tolerance policing unit that we thought was totally incompatible with the whole notion of the collaborative. And we fought for several years to get rid of it, because we know that when you pick up loiterers and stop people for no good reason, and you're doing it only in the black community, and you're not doing the same thing in the white community, all you're doing is irritating and oppressing a whole segment of the population and perpetuating a lot of the tension that we were trying to overcome. So it took us a while to even get on the same page and explain why that wasn't collaborative policing.
And moving them from one corner down three blocks
is not the answer.
Corner.
Yeah, it's not the answer.
Yeah, it's one thing for this change to sell the actual people who are physically, literally sitting at the table on the change and the process and what it's going to look like. But what about the members of the community who weren't literally at the table? What did it take, or is it still a work in progress, to convince members of the black community that things are different than they were 10 years ago?
It's very much a work in progress.
It's still a work in progress.
Yeah.
And we used to read, we actually had a radio show, the Black United Front. We had a radio show at that time. And so we stayed in constant contact with the community by way of our radio show. And we met, it seems like, every other day with different groups. We didn't move without the community. So the community, this thing was sexy then. People really wanted change. People really wanted to work at getting change and really understanding what change meant. So that meant that the community had to have a different look-see into moving into the future. So we just couldn't be mad. Oh, yeah, because we were mad as hell and still mad. But you had to be mad enough to get up to go do the work and be able to look at the people that you're blaming, as Kathy said. What we would say, I mean, the first couple of years just was, would turn into arguments in the room. And it was non-productive. We needed to be productive and produce something.
And we promised then that we were going to develop strategies to reduce arrests because we didn't want to feed mass incarceration. Now, 15 years later, we've done that. 15 years later, we are arresting half as many people for felonies and for misdemeanors in Cincinnati as we did back at the beginning of the collaborative. And that's good because we didn't think there needed to be that many arrests, and our crime rate hasn't gone up. In fact, it's gone down during this decrease in arrests. We've used problem solving as an alternative measure of keeping peace in the community while treating people fairly. We want to continue to reduce those arrests, and we want to make sure the community understands that we are arresting people much less, and that's no longer a measure of an officer's performance. And that's a big deal.
I don't want to give the impression that we were just in a room with a big table with attorneys and lawyers and the police administration and the mayor and the city manager. You had those meetings, but almost every night of the week, 3-4 nights a week for 3 years, if not longer, you had Al and Iris, myself, Don Harden, other community leaders going out to the Urban League, to all these other community centers, talking about what was going on, trying to explain to them the process of, and me trying to say, well, this is how we police, this is what we're doing, these are the changes that we're making. So we weren't just sitting at a table in a room with attorneys and a federal monitor. We were out in the community explaining what was going on and asking for ideas from the communities as well.
Al mentioned when he was kind of going through the list of stakeholders, one jumped out at me, and that was the spouses of police officers. What do they have to do with this?
Oh, everything. And the thing, I think that's when officers actually believed or saw a ray at the end of the tunnel, because no one had ever really asked them what their opinion was.
Right.
No one asked them what changes they wanted. Their spouses, are at home when they came home frustrated and upset and complaining about their supervisors, complaining about what occurred that day at work. So when this process started, we actually had meetings to where no supervisors were permitted. It was strictly police officers, no supervisors, where they could speak freely, not be afraid of what they were going to say.
Very safe spaces.
They then brought in the spouses of officers and said, well, what are you seeing? What's being brought home to you? What do you think the administration needs to do for your husband or wife To help them to do their job better. So it was. I think that's what really sold it to the officers as well, is knowing that, you know what, this may be actually something that may make change. And Mitch, they started to trust it.
And Mitch, if we had a grid to show you, and if we could show you what all eight stakeholder groups said, we almost all said the same exact thing. And those are the beauties that come out of hard work like this, very hard work. This not easy, as Kathy said, not at all. We were not loving in the beginning. It was as tense as you can possibly imagine. So to see a grid and everybody had their own safe space to be able to be free and talk, and to see that people actually wanted the same thing was a beautiful thing.
And not only did the groups come up with the same vision, but then when we had our class action fairness hearing to approve the settlement, the Archbishop testified. We're a very Catholic town. It was very important to have the faith leaders. The Baptist minister groups mm-hmm. had their leadership testify. So there was a lot of real unity in the fact that what we had written and what we implemented for these last 15 years actually reflected the conversation and dialogue that we had established throughout all these different stakeholder groups.
Is there anything unique about Cincinnati that would lead you to believe that the model that you developed couldn't be applied anywhere else?
Well, I wouldn't say that Cincinnati is unique. What I will say is the people and the amount of work that they did was very unique. The commitment that was shown was very unique. I mean, we're talking about hours and hours and hours of time put in that people weren't getting paid for. They were doing it, you know, from the heart. I mean, it was a very unique situation. I'm, you know, the union president sitting at a table with Al Gerhardstein, who every single month, years before that, was suing 20 to 25 of our police officers every month for civil rights violations. Iris Rowley, who was screaming and yelling and being a big activist.
The angriest black woman.
And on TV, and there you are. We're sitting trying to come to an agreement that we all knew needed to happen, but where we were at that time with different jobs and having different, you know, past experiences. She might say it differently. I think the thing that was unique about Cincinnati, and I think you need to have this when you go to do that, and you don't understand the amount of work and commitment that it takes, is the fact that you had a group that was so committed, and we had a judge that was unrelenting.
I think that, you know, one of the good things we didn't have was Facebook. We had to focus on our issues. The other thing that was unique about the process is that the community was there from start to finish. You don't see that in other consent decrees across the country, but we were there. We voted on everything. We helped make decisions. We helped design. We helped implement. We are there. So I think that is the unique part. And people, they typically look at us and say, you work with the police. Well, that's what the agreement calls for. That's what we agreed to.
So the community was not any different than a lot of other communities, but the process that we used was definitely different. Today, there are 17 cities under DOJ consent decrees. There is no other city that's ever had the FOP at the table. There's no other city that's ever had the community as a party to the lawsuit that actually is being court supervised. And that was really huge. That was a big deal.
And it's also important that we actually went in the court to make sure the word collaborative was used and not consent decree. I mean, it sounds silly now, but that was like so important. Mm-hmm. I mean, we wanted to use the word collaborative because it was a very collaborative approach.
Well, and the reason I asked that question was it sounds like if there were advice you were to give Milwaukee, it would start with those things that you just said there, this willingness to work tirelessly.
Exactly. I would say to Milwaukee, grow up. The adults need to be the adults and set the example for those that are coming. And it is just time out for just the rhetoric. It is time for change that you can see, change that you can feel, and change that you can be a part of, and that can last. We are a testament of that. What we can do is look back 15 years and tell you what not to do.
Well, I appreciate that all three of you sat around this table, Al Gerhardstein, Kathy Harrell, and Iris Rowley. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Al Gerhardstein is a civil rights attorney from Cincinnati. Kathy Harrell is a Cincinnati police officer and past president of the city's chapter of the Fraternal Order of Police. And Iris Rowley is project manager for Black United Front. You can find a link to more information about the Milwaukee effort to establish better police and community relations at WUWM.com.